We're discussing the national surge of racist attacks and harassment targeting Asian Americans and what hate crimes and anti-Asian sentiment mean for communities right here in Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A week ago, President Biden said in his address to the nation, this has to stop.
Vicious hate crimes against Asian Americans who've been attacked, harassed, blamed, and scapegoated.
What do you think of the president condemning hate crimes against Asian Americans? Have you been targeted? How have you and your family been affected? Can you speak out? It's 800-642-1234. Chai Mua is Community Power Coalition Director at Freedom, Inc. That's a Dane County nonprofit working in low to no income communities of color. She's also a Portage County Board Supervisor. Chai, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me this morning.
Well, let's start with Hmong Americans, who are Wisconsin's largest Asian ethnic group. Our state has the third largest Hmong population in the country outside of Minnesota and California. What challenges have Hmong and other Southeast Asian communities been facing in these difficult times?
Yeah, I think what our community is facing in these difficult times is nothing new to our communities. This anti-Asian hate has a long history here in Wisconsin. I think during this pandemic, we've just a lot of that really surfacing and folks being, just really right out expressing their hate, as well as seeing how, the inequities in our systems allow this to continue to happen.
Chai, what is driving this hate?
When you have people in the highest seat of government who continue to pour fuel onto hate that already exists, then you see this kind of stuff happen. when you see policies from our highest level of government that continue to oppress a group of people, then you see this continue to happen and continue to rise.
there are some people say that, no, this isn't happening in my backyard. This is happening in big cities, mm-hmm. but not in my community, not in my, small community in Wisconsin. What do you make of that thinking?
I live in Portage County, and we pride ourselves on, being a small community that this doesn't happen. But sadly, I was just reminded on one of my Facebook reminders that 4 years ago, we had a hate crime happen in Portage County. We had a white man who came out and shot at his Hmong neighbors. Who out loud to police had said how much he hated his Hmong neighbors and he hated the Hmong people. And so it's nothing new, but I think even in Portage County, a lot of these incidences go unreported because they're incidences. They're not something that actually equates to being chargeable. And on top of that, I think many of our communities are, many of our community members are survivor of war. And we can see that the police isn't always protecting us when they're supposed to. So when these incidences of hate actually, the police can't do anything or the police actually won't do anything. We don't call and we don't report.
When you say, surviving war, are you talking about refugee status? Explain that more, because Hmong Americans, a large population came after the Vietnam War.
Yes. When I say surviving war, I'm talking about surviving the Vietnam War, surviving the refugee camps, surviving authority that actually don't protect us when they're supposed to, and then re-experiencing that here in the United States, living in low to no income communities.
We're talking with Chai Mua, who is Freedom Inc.'s Community Power Coalition Director and a Portage County Board Supervisor. We're looking at hate crimes against Asian Americans and what to do about it here in Wisconsin and getting your thoughts. What do you think about the crimes that you've seen this week and certainly the sentiment there about Asian Americans? What are you doing to prevent it in your community? 800-642-1234. Last summer, you know, demonstrators took to the streets to protest anti-Black racism. And this year, people are protesting anti-Asian racism in cities all across the nation following pandemic-related racism. And we talked with UW-Madison Professor Cindy Efen Chang about this last summer.
We have numerous verbal blames against for the virus against Asian Americans in Milwaukee. We see tons of reports in Madison, Wisconsin. We see this kind of increased behavior happening in Green Bay, where there's reports of vandalism on Asian markets.
Are these incidents swept up, you know, swept under the rug, or are they cited? What happens when you have these incidents?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of times when these incidences happen, either like we don't know or catch the perpetrator, or it actually doesn't, like I said earlier, it's an incident. Mm. So, you know, it's an incident and not necessarily equate to a crime. We can just see as recently as, I believe it was Monday morning, of the van of the Hmong American Center in Marathon County was vandalized. Mm. But there was no way of catching who it was that had vandalized the van. And even when that has happened, again, it's an incident. Like, how far is the what is the police going to actually do when the policies are actually, you know, like, the policies really aren't there that makes it easy to even charge a hate crime. We have seen with the Junction City incident here, where the white man shot at his neighbor, it was young Hmong women who actually took to the streets to pressure the district attorney to even push on a hate crime enhancer to that.
Is that what it's going to take? Is protests, pressure from community members who stand up, maybe who raise a sign or who say something?
Yes, and it's also going to really take those of us who are in leadership positions to continue to push for policy changes. Because, you know, like, I feel the ultimate form of anti-Asian crimes is the policies. The ultimate form of anti-Black crimes is the policies. Well, we're talking about things that actually happen to individuals. Everything happens to individuals. As we're talking about these certain crimes, we're not looking at how policies have affected us. On Monday, 33 Vietnamese deportees were deported back to Vietnam. The deportation of Southeast Asians, the deportation of refugees itself is anti-Asian.
We're talking with Chai Mua, who works on racial equity issues at Freedom Inc. That's a Madison-based nonprofit engaging low- to no-income communities of color. What do you think law enforcement should do about the attacks targeting Asian Americans? Have you witnessed discrimination online or racial encounters in person? How did you react in the moment? What would you do differently if you could relive the moment? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chai Mua here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing anti-Asian American hate incidents, why they have skyrocketed in the past year. A group of researchers published incident data this week on a forum called Stop Asian American and Pacific Islander Hate. They reported nearly 3,800 incidents over the past year of the pandemic, a sharp rise from the previous year. How has your school, your workplace, or spiritual congregation shown support toward Asian Americans in the wake of these attacks? What should be done to stop them? Join in 800-642-1234. Chai Mua is with Freedom Inc., working to root out racial bias at the community level. She's a Portage County supervisor, stays with us for 10 more minutes. Lisa is joining us now from Madison. Hi, Lisa. What would you like to bring?
I think it's really important that people know that the Hmong population also have refugee status because they helped the Americans during the Vietnam War. And because we lost the war, they were given safety and refuge here. The other piece is, you know, people are often afraid because of the people they don't know. And 25 years ago, I had an opportunity to work at a community center in Madison. There was a large Hmong population. And, you know, just as anybody would expect, a wonderful group of people. I was given a Hmong calendar, hand-stitched Hmong calendar by an elderly Hmong woman. And it is one of the things I absolutely treasure. I hang in a place of importance in my home. They're wonderful people, and people just need to speak and get to know each other.
Oh, Lisa, thank you so much. Chai, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. You know, I think one thing is speaking and really know each other. But, you know, I think on top of that, too, is how do we build real solidarity? So that it goes beyond, like, I know this person, and to be, like, actually, I'm going to stand up against racist policies. I'm going to stand up and pressure for change, for racial equity, right?
I want to ask you about some recent legislation in Congress. Democratic U.S. Representative Grace Meng of New York reintroduced a bill to address the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, and she spoke with NPR's All Things Considered earlier this week.
Right now, what's happening, especially at the federal level, is we're not getting enough data from local law enforcement and the local communities. Mm. So we really want to use this as a community education effort. We want the Department of Justice to work with local community groups, you know, publish information in multiple languages.
So this bill would appoint a Justice Department official to expedite reviews of hate crimes and give guidance to local law enforcement on accurately reporting these incidents, these hate crimes. What do you think of this legislation?
Yeah, I mean, any legislation that will continue to put the Justice Department or law enforcement as the point of contact will not work.
Hmm.
You know, I really think that local communities and those who are already doing the work on the ground, we are the best trusted sources for the incidences to be reported. When incidences were happening here in Portage County, people didn't call the police. People were calling me. People are calling me and saying, this is what's happening to me, because they don't trust the police. They don't trust the Justice Department to report these incidences.
What did you do when you got those calls?
You know, at the beginning of the year last year, at the beginning of the pandemic, Safer at Home in Wisconsin last year, I got a call from my nephew, and I actually had to show up. And I'm glad that I did, because by the time I got there, there was 5 police cars pulled up behind him, pulled him over for an incident in a grocery store where he was yelled at and not welcomed in the grocery store by another shopper. While the white man who yelled got away and got to go home, 5 police cars held up my nephew. I actually had to get out, do more education, stop them and say, hey, like, you can't do this. And I truly felt that if I didn't show up, he would have been the one that had gotten a disorderly conduct ticket, because law enforcement don't fully understand the issues at hand. And on top of that, you know, we've experienced systems that are supposed to protect us that actually don't.
Mm. Helen is with us from Little Chute. Helen, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Early in my career, I worked outside of Boston as a manager, and I'm now retired living in Wisconsin. And in the course of my career, I've had over 100 employees, and I had the pleasure of having a woman work for me who was a boat. Her family, they were boat people from Vietnam. And I wanted to say that Trin was the most phenomenal employee I've had in my entire career. Hardworking, easy to get along with, very fast at everything she did. To this day, I think back and I thought, wow, if she could have been cloned 100 times, what an easy career I would have had. Breaks my heart to hear about these atrocities against these Asian Americans, because they make such a phenomenal contribution to America. And sadly, instead of making America great, our former president has really divided us, and America really needs to step up and welcome these phenomenal Americans. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Helen, thank you for sharing your story. Chai, you know, Helen is exposing and showing in the workplace, too, these relationships. Mm-hmm. These relationships are all around mm-hmm. us. How can mm-hmm. people educate themselves about these issues and also make these community relationships meaningful?
Yes, you know, and I think that the workplace is actually the best place to start. You know, we've seen during this uprising this summer that many workplaces are now taking racial equity as a priority and, you know, and offering during work time trainings and spaces for the employees to learn. I see here in Portage County locally how businesses are taking this up, you know, as a personal matter for their business, and seeing that racial equity has to be core to the organization in their business. So this is very important in the workplace.
What
regardless
have you,
of what kind of work.
Yeah. What have you seen advancements with Freedom Inc., your organization in this area, mm-hmm. and making those connections and providing those resources?
Yeah. Well, you know, we have had many invitations to provide political education or to provide resources that folks can actually bring back to their different groups. You know, and then I think, like, on top of that, there are many ways that folks can locally get involved. I think, like, when something like what has happened this week in Georgia happens, everybody wants to, like, pour into Georgia. But what we forget is that locally, this is happening in our own backyards. And so, yeah, get involved in different organizations that fight for racial equity and help build them up to be able to give resources.
We're talking with Chai Mua, who is Freedom Inc.'s Community Power Coalition Director, and going now to Vic in Portage County. Hi, Vic. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Yeah, I, you know, I've grown up here in Wisconsin and in Michigan. I'm a first generation Dutch Indonesian, and I guess through the 60s and 70s, I remember my mom, who is Indonesian from the island of Java, and always telling us, you know, to, you know, downplay that side of our heritage. And so I guess I, you know, I've dealt with that forever. I'm very proud of my heritage. However, there was this underlying theme that really permeated our culture that never went unnoticed by me. And it became more magnified even, you know, over these past 4 years that, wow, that's really real. And, you know, the way I look really had an impact because I did look different and I could, you know, not hide, but, you know, downplay that part of my heritage. And I just feel so it's not right. It's not, you know, it's very, you know, deep-seated. And yeah, my siblings had to deal with that as well. So,
Vic, thank you for sharing that. Chai, you know, what do you do with this deep-seated downplaying of your heritage? Is this widespread?
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, I think, like, many folks have the same experience. We've seen in the Hmong community how this, you know, like this almost like self-hatred, or not so much hatred, but like hiding who you are, that side of you, and trying to be as American as possible. This is all part of white supremacy, right? To try to prove how much closer you are to being white so that you don't experience these kind of experiences. And we've seen that historically. And, you know, now we're having to come back and reteach our own people self-love.
Chai, thank you so much for joining us. Chai Mua is Community Power Coalition Director at Freedom, Inc. and a Portage County Board Supervisor. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show, I'm Kate Archer Kent. Over the past year, WPR and Wisconsin Watch have documented the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. 1 year into the pandemic, we asked them to listen back to their early diaries and reflect. Bram Sable-Smith has more.
Mariah Clark is an emergency department nurse at UW Health in Madison, where the state's first COVID-19 patient was treated last year.
I'll never forget that first COVID patient. I'd been reading about COVID in the news for a month at that point, but when that first case rolled into the department, I remember having that sensation of, oh, shit, it's here. And wondering how it was going to change everything. It's been a strange year of dualities. There were aspects of COVID that let us really connect back to the fact that we as nurses are there to care for whole people and not just assemblages of parts that aren't working right at the time. And I think in some ways, you know, the terror of the disease also let us regain a little bit of that odd humanity too, because we had seen friends or family or coworkers who had gotten ill. We could picture ourselves there. And it felt, a lot of the time, a lot more human.
When Jessica Barrera revisits her thoughts from early in the pandemic, she can't help but recall her anxiety. She spent months waiting for unemployment assistance after she lost her job in Eau Claire.
There were so many unknowns. There was so much that was out of my control. It makes me feel tired almost to hear myself. I think a year ago, most of us were just surviving day to day, emotionally, mentally, physically, financially, just to get through to the next day. And if I could talk to myself a year ago, or if I knew then what I know now, I would let her know that you get used to wearing a mask. It's not so weird after the first little while. And to just keep your faith that things will get better.
Amy Moreland of Madison was laid off from her job as a bartender last March. She was unemployed for nearly a year before deciding to go back to school.
A lot has changed in that year. I like to think about, like, you know, sometimes just imagining being, like, older, like, you know, and talking to, like, grandkids about this time that we survived and how we're, like, kind of living through history right now and telling our grandkids about, you know, the quarantine and all this and it being something that we got through. And I don't know what I hope is different about next year is I hope that I am thriving again. You know, you can truly be excited about everything that's coming and grieve the things that have passed as well. So that's where I'm at right now is I'm really excited for the future, but I do feel a sense of sadness for the things that I've lost as well. And I do grieve the past because it's never going to be exactly the same.
Adija Greer Smith owns Confectionately Yours, a Milwaukee bakery that had to shut its doors for several months.
It's so hard to believe even now that we're a year into this pandemic and we, you know, our kids are still home and we're living in masks. But, you know, I personally think that we may be this way for a while. 2020 was just catastrophic in so many ways. But for Confectionately Yours, I would say the later part of the year was really good to us. You know, it opened up so many doors of opportunity. You know, one thing that I knew coming into entrepreneurship was that I had to go through a process. Clearly, this was a part of that process. Had I opened my business 10 years ago, I may not have experienced this obstacle. But this process really made me stronger. My hope for just people is that this year would have taught us all to love more and hate less, because life is so very precious.
86-year-old Door County resident Beverly Bleets struggled with isolation throughout the year. Now, she has a new outlook.
Well, on my walk today, I felt the satisfaction and the joy of the coming of spring. At the same time, it's hard for me to believe that we'll soon observe the first anniversary of the recognition of the existence of the pandemic. The older I get, the faster the time passes, but the urgency, the threat, the fright of the tragedy that is COVID have been replaced in my life with a more peaceful resolution. A year ago, I grieved that time was being snatched from me, that the loss of the old normal meant the loss of so much that was meaningful in my life. But with the passing of the year, instead, I learned to direct my thinking and to better understand the virtue of the new normal and its restrictions. More than ever, the importance of my family and relationships has taken precedence over the more frenzied activity of a daily calendar. I am content to be who I am and where I am in time. It is with profound gratitude that, so far, I am privileged to enjoy yet another coming of spring.
And to hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Now to Marquette University, where 39 staff layoffs earlier this year left some faculty disheartened and critical of the administration's move to cut jobs and classes to help address financial challenges. Marquette faculty formed a new chapter of the American Association of University Professors, or AAUP, in November. We spoke with Marquette's provost earlier this month about the cuts. Are you a Marquette student or faculty member? How do you feel about recent cuts to staffing and class offerings this fall? 800-642-1234. Douglas Smith is an assistant professor of practice in Marquette's College of Business Administration. He is president of the Marquette chapter of the AAUP, which represents faculty and shared governance at the university. Doug, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
What is the position of your AAUP chapter on these layoffs earlier this year?
Well, we haven't gotten a lot of information about the layoffs. We recognize that with respect to the financial condition of the university, that some adjustments are appropriate. The problem was that none of these adjustments, at least even in general, were discussed with faculty in accordance with shared governance. The idea is that faculty should at least have the opportunity to evaluate and comment on what's happening, because administration doesn't know everything it needs to know about the decisions that are being made. University is a very interrelated and complex institution, and none of that happens. So even in terms of which positions all have gone away, that's still not known to everybody. But we know that some of the positions, for example, in our Office of International Education, have left that office very short-staffed. Now, in the pandemic, that's not going to be a problem in the short term, but in the long term, it certainly is. Faculty could have given important feedback to administration if they had only let us know what they were planning to do.
Do you think the university is moving too quickly to change with not enough buy-in?
Absolutely. Part of the issue is buy-in, and part of the issue is information. The university leadership has made decisions based on projections about what's going to happen in the fall and in future years that aren't fully validated. We can think about the expectation that we're going to have a significant reduction in freshman enrollment in the fall, when the numbers don't seem to suggest that so far. And given the pace of vaccinations coming up and our commitment to return to near normal operations, we believe that things are not going to be as bad as administration seems to want to think they're going to be.
But I mean, looking at the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center, that data that is coming out, undergraduate enrollment continues to drop. This is a shrinking number of people. You know, what do you think of the position that if Marquette doesn't make these budget and staffing adjustments now, it could get much worse off in the future?
Well, we're in this position because administration hasn't been foresighted enough to actually plan for disruptive events. We could have easily, over the last 5 years, accumulated enough of a rainy day fund to help us work through this. Marquette's been here for 140 years. There have been a lot of disruptive events over that time. And so we have to expect and plan for those. Do I expect that we will need to revamp our approach to education in some areas in order to continue to attract students? Absolutely. But let's remember, Marquette is a top 100 university. Last year in U.S. News and World Report, we were ranked number 18 in best undergraduate teaching. And there is no reason that we can't compete effectively for even a reduced pool of students in the future.
Earlier this month, we spoke with the provost, Kimoa Yoon, who joined us to talk about these cuts. And here's what he said when we asked if there would be more cuts.
We have none planned at this time, but, you know, we are a tuition-driven institution. 75% of the monies that we bring in comes through tuition. So in large part, that's, you know, dependent on the students that are here.
So very much tuition dependent. Do you think there will be more cuts in the future?
Well, at the time the provost said that, he had already set in motion a process by which additional faculty would be not renewed for next fall. And so there's been a significant reduction in course offerings. Some course sections have doubled in size with respect to students. We still don't know what all that looks like yet. We may not know that for a little while, but we do know that many faculty, non-tenure track faculty, have been given notice that either they won't be renewed next year or they'll be renewed at a significantly reduced level of teaching and compensation. So the suggestion, I think, that those 39 announced cuts would relieve financial pressure on Marquette wasn't acknowledging that many other faculty were going to not be here because of decisions made by the leadership, not because of an absolute need to make those changes right now.
So if you reduce the number of classes, if you have hundreds of fewer class offerings, where does that leave the programs?
Well, some of the programs have been will be significantly harmed by that. Programs that maybe were in the process of changing to accommodate the needs of today's student are going to be hamstrung in trying to continue to make those changes. And most of those programs seem to be in the College of Arts and Sciences. I've always thought of that college as the heart of the university. That's where liberal arts occurs. That's where critical thinking is taught in all of the courses that are offered in the College of Arts and Sciences. And that seems to be the place where the budget cuts that have been allocated by university leadership have fallen most hard.
We have Attorney Doug Smith with us as we discuss the future at Marquette. Doug is part of Marquette's business faculty, president of its AAUP chapter, which stands for American Association of University Professors. What are your thoughts about how the pandemic is affecting private universities like Marquette? How much about the financial health of a private university should its leadership share with faculty and staff? How do you feel about how Marquette is weathering the economic toll of the pandemic? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Doug Smith here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about Marquette University's job cuts, financial position, enrollment. From a national perspective, the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center has tracked the pandemic's impact on higher ed enrollment for nearly a year. Its spring data show that undergraduate enrollment continues to tumble and there's no quick turnaround in sight. Are you worried about tough decisions at your alma mater? What is the viability of programs, coursework? What does that mean for its overall mission? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We have business faculty member Doug Smith, who leads the Marquette AAUP chapter, which represents faculty in shared governance at the university. Doug, there was a leadership meeting yesterday afternoon. Who was at the table for that and what happened?
Well, our provost set up a number of work groups, and this one dealt with future academic programs. It was more of a listening session than providing a lot of detail to faculty about what's going on. But it was one of the more positive meetings that we've had so far, and I think there was a good amount of faculty feedback that will be taken into account. Unfortunately, the view of the provost and administration about how many programs need to be cut or in what dollar amounts are still out there without being addressed. And so we don't really know what direction administration wants to take that issue.
Do you know what next steps look like, where this meeting is headed and where these work groups are headed?
Well, by the end of this academic year, sometime in May, these groups will all be generating their final reports. Unfortunately, with respect to some of the other work groups that have already ended their activities, in many respects, their recommendations were not particularly followed by administration. And so from our perspective in the AAUP chapter, we want to make sure that faculty have spent a lot of time and energy putting their recommendations together. We want to make sure that those are fully vetted. We want to make sure that those are fully considered, and we want to make sure that administration is putting together a coherent plan for us to go forward.
Let's bring in Alan now in Madison with a question. Hi, Alan, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. So you mentioned that Marquette is a largely tuition-funded school, right? And if there's a potential for tuition to decrease in the future, I think it's important to think about how cuts might be balanced across different areas of expenditures. So I know spending on staff and faculty, just like payroll, is one of the major expenses. But there's also lots of capital expenses that are required to attract new students, right? Building new facilities and renovating old ones. So what do you think a good way to balance those kind of competing funding needs is?
Alan, thank you. Yeah, payroll versus capital expenditures. How do you balance that out, Doug?
Well, first of all, we have to look at how much of our budget is being spent on academic programs. And when we compare ourselves to other Jesuit institutions, we are pretty anemic. Now, administration has said that that data is not very helpful and that it's a little bit misleading, but they've not given us yet any sense that our balance of non-academic and academic expenses is appropriate for this institution. So that becomes our first consideration. With respect to capital budgets, those are things that faculty generally don't have a lot of input on. I would say that we are building a new business building here at Marquette. It is completely donor funded, and that is the right plan for us to go forward. If we have donors who are providing the funds necessary for us to expand our capital facilities, it also provides us with the ability to assign appropriate amounts of our budget in order to maintain the ones that we already have and that we continue to need.
In the pandemic, what has the university received by way of federal COVID relief aid? Do you have insights there?
Well, we know that in the last COVID relief bill, the university received almost $10 million. Now, about a third of that was allocated entirely to student relief. But if the students were spending that, of course, on tuition and room and board, that money ultimately comes back to Marquette. The remaining $6.6 million is for the university to use. We've asked how that money has been allocated. We've not had administration tell us how that money is going to be used.
What is morale like now among your colleagues, among your peers?
Well, I would say that it's low. It's been a tough year. Faculty have worked as hard, if not harder, than they ever have, especially for student engagement. That has been the biggest issue that I've seen and that other faculty I've talked to have seen. We have to spend way more time reaching out to students, getting them to engage, finding out what they need, making adjustments to courses. We, of course, had to change our course modalities almost overnight a year ago in order to make sure that operations continue to run. But the other part of faculty morale is having an understanding that the leadership is committed to mission, and this university has a unique and specific mission of creating transformational students, transformational experiences that create men and women for others. And also they need to have an understanding that there is a future here, that the university has a clear plan for being able to handle disruptive events in the future. That's why the Academic Senate passed a resolution asking administration to begin this process, and Academic Senate is going to be active in trying to get administration to revise our financial planning processes so that when disruptive events occur, we can adjust to them without cutting staff, cutting faculty, ending programs.
Doug, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Doug Smith is an assistant professor of practice in Marquette's College of Business Administration, president of the Marquette chapter of the AAUP, which represents faculty and shared governance at the university. We spoke with Marquette's provost, Kimu Ayun, about the cuts on March 4th. Just ahead is a caller-only edition of The Morning Show. We invite you to share your ideas for future programs, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.